About bleeding time, Cook says when she sees me. Get down there. A few of these slaves know the way out. Follow. Cook sees my face and groans when she realizes that I have no plans to leave, at least not until everyone is through. Even as she speaks, more scholars arrive. I see marshals now too, most of whom are plebeians, judging by their clothing. They are drawn by the crowd, assuming rightly that there is a reason so many scholars flock here. Bleeding hells, girl, Cook says. Do you see what you've done? I gesture the marshals in. I'm not going to tell a mother with a crying child she can't escape through here, I snap. I don't care if she's marshal or not. Are you? Damn you, girl, Cook snarls. You're just like your fa-fav. She presses her mouth closed and turns away in frustration. Move, you bleeding sloths! She unleashes her wrath on the scholars closest to her. There are hundreds behind you who want to live as badly as you do. Urged on by Cook's threats, the scholars slowly make their way through the tunnels and the embassy begins to empty, but not swiftly enough. The Karkans are closing in, pouring through the streets. The marshals are overcome. As I watch, I see an ox squad go down, blood and viscera spraying the air red. And despite the fact that I know the Empire's evils firsthand, my eyes grow hot. I will never understand the savagery of war, even when it is my foes being destroyed. Time to go, girl. Cook appears at my shoulder and shoves me down the steps to the cellar. I do not protest. No doubt there are scholars still left in the city, but I have done what I can. Help me with this. She bars the cellar door, her hands steady. Above, glass breaks, followed by the harsh barks of the Karkans. Cook fiddles with something in the door, eventually pulling out what looks like a very long candle wick. Moments later, it is sparking. Take cover! We run to the door that leads to the tunnel, pulling it shut just as the ground begins shuddering. The tunnels groan, and for long moments, I worry that stones above us will collapse. But when the dust clears, the passageway has held. And I turn to Cook. Explosives? How? The mariners had a stockpile, Cook says. Moose's little friends showed me. Well, girl, that's it. Tunnel's sealed. Now what? Now, I say, we get the hells out of this city.
Chapter 55. The Bloodshrike. The Karkans flood Antium, breaching gate after gate, the screams of their warriors chilling me to my core. Their ghost-possessed fighters are gone, thanks perhaps to Elias. But the damage is done. They have decimated our forces. Marcus was right. The Empire's capital is lost. My rage is a pure, glowing flame that drives me to tear through any Karkan I see. And when in the distance I spot a familiar blonde figure making her way through the city with a handful of soldiers at her back, my anger burns white hot. You treacherous bitch! She stops when she hears me but takes her sweet time turning around. How could you? My voice breaks. Your own people? Just for the throne? What is the point of being empress if you have no love for those you rule? If you have no one to rule over? Empress? She cocks her head. To be empress is the least of my desires, girl. Why stop at empress? Why, when the Nightbringer would offer me dominion over the tribes, the scholars, the mariners, the Karkans, over all the world of man? No. Oh, bleeding hells, no. I lunge for her then, because I have nothing to lose now. No paters to placate, no orders to follow. Just a bolt of wrath that possesses me like a demon spirit. She steps easily to the side. And in moments her men, all masks, have me pinned. A knife gleams in her hand, and she runs it lightly down my face, tracing my forehead, my cheeks. I wonder if it will hurt, she murmurs, Then she turns around, leaps onto her mount, and rides away. Her men hold me until she is long gone, before casting me to the side of a road like offal. I do not chase them. I do not even look at them. The commandant could have killed me. Instead, she left me alive. Skies only know why, but I will not waste this chance. I listen to the drums, and soon enough I am racing toward the men of the Black Guard who still live, along with a few hundred soldiers, as they hold off a wave of attackers from a square in a Makata district. I search the faces for Dex, hoping to the skies that he's still alive, and nearly crush his ribs when he finds me. "Where the bleeding hells are our men, Dex," I shout over the cacophony. "This can't be all that's left." Dex shakes his head, bleeding from a dozen wounds. "This is it. The evacuation? Thousands make their way through the Augur's caves. Thousands more are still in the tunnels. The entrances have been collapsed. Those who could get through..." I hold up a hand. The drum tower closest to us thuds out a message. It is almost lost amid all the noise, but I just make out the end of it. Karkan force approaching Pilgrim's Gap. "Harper has our people coming out just beyond the gap," I say. "Livia," my mind screams at me. "The baby. The Karkans must have scouts up there. If those bastards get through the gap, they'll slaughter everyone Harper has evacuated." "Why follow us?" Dex says. "Why, when they know they have the city?" "Because Grimmar knows we won't let him keep Antium," I say. "And he wants to make damn sure that while his men have the advantage, they kill as many of us as possible so we can't fight them later." I know what I must say, and I make myself say it. "The city is lost. It belongs to Grimmar now. Skies help the poor souls who remain here under that fiend. I will not forget them, but right now I cannot save them, not if I want to save those who do have a chance at escape. Get out this order. Every soldier we have is to report to the gap immediately. That is our last stand. If we stop them, that is where we will do it." By the time Dex, my men, and I reach the gap, just beyond the northern border of the city, the Karkan force is on the march, bent on crushing us. As I watch them pour out of Antium's northern gate and up the Pilgrim Road, I know that we will not win this battle. I have with me no more than 1,000 men. The enemy has more than 10,000, and thousands more they can call from the city if they must. Even with our superior blades, we cannot beat them. Pilgrim's Gap is a 10-foot-wide opening between two sheer cliffs that sit atop a wide valley. The Pilgrim Road curves across the valley, through the gap, and toward the Augur's caves. I glance back over my shoulder, away from the Karkans. I had hoped when I arrived that the Pilgrim Road would be empty, that the evacuees would have gotten through. But there are hundreds of marshals, and scholars I notice, on the road, and hundreds more emerging from the tunnel entrances to make their way up to the Augur's caves. "Get a message to Harper," I tell Dex. "Take it yourself. White smoke when the last person is through. Then he's to collapse the entrance to the caves. He is not to wait, and neither are you." "Shrike, that is an order, Lieutenant Atreus. You keep us safe. You keep my nephew safe. You see him on the throne." My friend stares at me. He knows what I am saying. That I don't want him back here. That I will die here today, with my people, and he will not. "Duty first," he salutes, "unto death." I turn to my men. Masks, orcs, legionnaires, all have survived onslaught after onslaught. They are exhausted. They are broken. I have heard many pretty speeches as a soldier. I remember none of them. So in the end I dig up words that Karis gave me long ago, and I hope to the skies that they will come back to haunt her. "There is success," I say, And there is failure. The land in between is for those too weak to live. Duty first, unto death. They roar it back at me, and we form up, row upon row of shields and spears and sims. Our archers have few arrows, but they ready what they do have. The rumble in the valley grows louder as the carcans surge up the rise toward us. And now my blood sings, and I pull out my warhammer and snarl, "Come on, you bastards! Come for me!" And suddenly, the carcans are a distant rumble no more, but a thundering, frenzied horde of thousands who want nothing more than to annihilate all that is left of us. In the pass behind us, the pilgrims cry out. Now, I think, let us see what the marshals are made of. After an hour, the carcans have ripped through the front half of our forces. All is blood and pain and brutality. Still I fight, and the men fight beside me, as behind us, those fleeing the city continue up the road. Faster, I think at them, for the love of the skies, go faster. We wait for the white smoke as the carcans keep coming, wave upon wave. Our force dwindles from 500 men to 400, 200, 50. No smoke. The gap is too wide for us to hold it much longer. It is piled with bodies, but the carcans simply climb over them and down, as if the hill is made of rock and not their dead countrymen. From the city a hellish sound rises. It is worse than the silence of Blackcliff after the third trial, worse than the tortured moans of Corfe's prisoners. It is the screaming of those I left behind as they faced the violence of the carcans. The wolves are among my people now. We cannot falter. There are still hundreds on the pilgrim road and dozens emerging from the tunnels. A little more time. Just a little more. But we do not have more time, for to my left, two more of my men fall, cut down by cork and arrows. My hammer slips against my palm, slick from the blood that drenches every inch of my skin. But there are more coming. Too many. I cannot fight them all. I shout for aid. The only responses are the battle cries of the carcans. Which is when I understand, finally, that I am alone. There is no one else left to fight at my back. All of my men are dead. And still, more carcans surge over the wall of bodies. Skies, are their numbers unending? Will they ever give up? They will not, I realize, and it makes me want to scream and cry and kill. They will tear through this pass. They will be on the evacuees like jackals upon injured rabbits. I search the sky for white smoke. Please, please. And then I feel a sharp pain in my shoulder. Stunned, I look down to see an arrow sticking out of it. I deflect the next one that comes at me, but there are more bowmen coming. Too many. This is not happening. It cannot be. My sister is up there somewhere with the hope of the Empire held in her arms. She might not have reached the caves yet. At the thought of her, of young Zacharias, of the two little girls who said they'd fight the carcans, I draw on every last bit of strength I have. I am a thing from the barbarians' nightmares, a silver-faced, blood-drenched demon of the hells, and I will not let them pass. I kill. And I kill, and I kill. But I am no supernatural creature. I am flesh and blood, and I am flagging. Please, please, more time. I just need more time. But I have none. It is gone. One day soon you will be tested, child. All that you cherish will burn. You will have no friends that day, no allies, no comrades in arms. On that day, your trust in me will be your only weapon. I fall to my knees. Help me, I sob. Please, please help me. Please. But how can he help me if he cannot hear me? How can he offer aid if he is not here? Bloodshrike. I whirl to find the Nightbringer standing just behind me. His hand rises and flicks, and the Karkans stop, held back by the djinn's immense power. He surveys the carnage with dispassion. Then he turns to me, but does not speak. Whatever you want from me, take it, I say. Just save them, please.
I want a bit of your soul, Shrike.
You? I shake my head. I do not understand. Take my life, I say, if that is the price.
I want a bit of your soul.
I rack my mind desperately. I don't have. A memory comes to me. A ghost out of the darkness. Quinn's voice, weeks ago when I gave him Elias's mask.
They become part of us, you know. It is only when they join with us that we become our truest selves. My father used to say that after the joining, a mask held a soldier's identity, and that without it, a bit of his soul was stripped away, never to be recovered.
A bit of his soul. It's just a mask, I say. It's not...
The augurs themselves placed the last piece of a long-lost weapon in your mask, the Nightbringer says. I have known it since the day they gave it to you. All that you are. All that they molded you into. All that you have become. It was all for this day, Bloodshrike.
I don't understand.
Your love of your people runs deep. It was nurtured through all the years spent at Blackcliff. It grew deeper when you saw the suffering in Narvium and healed the children in the infirmary. Deeper when you healed your sister and imbued your nephew with the love you have of your country. Deeper still when you saw the strength of your countrymen as they prepared for the siege. It fused with your soul when you fought for them on the walls of Antium. And now, it culminates in your sacrifice for them.
Take off my head then, for I cannot remove it, I say, sobbing. It is part of me, a living part of my body. It has sunk into my skin.
That is my price, the Nightbringer says. I will not take from you. I will not threaten you or coerce you. The mask must be offered with love in your heart.
I look back over my shoulder at the Pilgrim Road. Hundreds make their way up, and I know thousands more are in the caves. We have already lost so many. We cannot lose more.
You are all that holds back the darkness.
For the Empire, for the mothers and fathers, for the sisters and brothers, for the lovers.
For the Empire, Helene Aquila. For your people.
I grab at my face and tear. I claw at my skin, howling, wailing, begging the mask to release me. I don't want you anymore. I just want my people to be safe. Release me, please, release me. For the Empire, release me. For my people, release me. Please. Please.
My face burns. Blood pours from where I have already clawed at the mask. Within, some essential part of me cries out at the recklessness with which I tear it away. A mask holds a soldier's identity. But I don't care about my identity. I don't even care if I'm a soldier anymore. I just want my people to live. To survive, to fight another day. The mask lets me go. Blood pours down my neck, my cheeks, into my eyes. I cannot see. I can hardly move. I retch from the searing agony of it.
Take it. My voice is as raw as the cook's. Take it and save them.
Why do you offer it to me, Shrike? Say it.
Because they are my people. I hold it out to him, and when he does not take it, I shove it into his hands. Because I love them. Because they do not deserve to die. Because I failed them.
He inclines his head, a gesture of deep respect, and I sag to the ground. I wait for him to wave his hand and wreak havoc. Instead, he turns and walks away, rising into the air like a leaf.
No! Why isn't he fighting the Karkans? Wait! I trusted you, please, you said. You have to help me!
He looks over his shoulder at something behind me, beyond me.
I have. Bloodshrike.
With that, he is gone. A dark cloud carried away by the wind. The power that held back the Karkans fails, and they tumble forward toward me. More than I can count. More than I can fight.
Come back.
I have no voice. It wouldn't matter if I did. The Nightbringer is gone. Skies, where is my Warhammer? My Sim? Anything. But I have no weapons. No strength left in my body. I have nothing.
Chapter 56. Liar. When I emerge from the tunnels and into the bright sunlight, I grimace at the reek of blood. A massive pile of bodies sits 100 yards away at the base of a narrow gap. Through it, I can make out the city of Antium, and beside the bodies, on her knees with the dark cloaked Nightbringer standing before her, is the Bloodshrike. I do not know what the Nightbringer says to the Bloodshrike. I only know that when she cries out, it sounds just like Nan did when she heard about my mother's death. Like I did when I understood how that djinn beast had betrayed me. It is a cry of loneliness, of betrayal, of despair. The djinn turns, looks in my direction, then he disappears on the wind. Girl, Cook scrambles up behind me, having swept the tunnels at my side to make sure that no one else lingered. The last scholars have long since disappeared. It is only us now. Let's go! They're coming! As more Karkans make their way through the gap, the Shrike crawls toward her Warhammer, attempting to stand. She lurches around to look behind her at the sky, where a plume of white smoke curls into the heavens. She sobs and sinks to her knees, dropping her hammer, bowing her head. I know then that she is ready to die. I also know that I cannot let her. I am already moving, away from Cook, away from the path to safety, and toward the Bloodshrike. I throw myself at the Karkan attacking her, and as he snaps at my throat with his teeth, I shove my dagger in his gut and then push him away. I only just manage to pull my knife free in time to shove it into the throat of another Karkan. A third attacks me from behind, and I stumble and roll out of the way just as an arrow explodes through his head. My jaw drops as Cook lets arrow after arrow fly, executing the Karkans with the precision of a mask. She stops to snatch up a quiver full of arrows from the back of a dead Karkan. Grab the Shrike! Cook gets her arm under the Bloodshrike's left shoulder, and I take her right. We stagger up the Pilgrim Road as swiftly as we can, but the Shrike can barely walk, and our progress is slow. There! Cook nods to a cluster of boulders. We clamber behind it and put the Shrike down. Dozens of Karkans climb through the gap. Soon, it will be hundreds. We have a few minutes, if that. How the hells do we get out of this? I whisper to Cook. We can't just leave her. Do you know why the Commandant never fails, girl? Cook doesn't seem to expect a reply to her bizarrely timed question, because she barrels on. because no one knows her story. Learn her story, and you'll learn her weakness. Learn her weakness, and you can destroy her. Talk to Musa about it. He'll help you. Why are you telling me this now? Because you're going to take vengeance on that savage demon queen for me, she says. And you need to know. Get up. Get the strike up that mountain. The marshals are going to seal off those caves soon enough. If they haven't already, you need to move quickly. A group of Karkans races up the pilgrim road toward us, and Cook rises and shoots a dozen arrows. The barbarians fall, but more come through the gap. I have another 50 arrows, girl, Cook says. Once I'm out, we're done for. We could fight 3 or 4 of those bastards at the most, not hundreds, not thousands. One of us has to hold them off. Oh no. I take her meaning now. Finally, I understand what she is saying. Absolutely bleeding. No, I will not leave you here to die. Go! My mother shoves me toward the shrike, and though her teeth are bared, her eyes are filled with tears. You don't want to save me. I'm not worth it. Go! I will not. Do you know what I did in Koff prison, girl? There is hatred in her eyes as she says it. Before I knew who she was, I would have thought that hate was directed at me. I understand now that it was never for me. It was for herself. If you did, you would run. I know what you did. Now is not the time to be noble. I grab her arm and try to drag her toward the shrike. She doesn't budge. You did it to save Darren and me, because Father and Lys weren't strong like you. And you knew that they would give us up eventually, and then we'd all die. I knew that the moment I learned of it, Mother. I forgave you the moment I learned of it. But you have to come with me. We can run. Damn you, girl! Cook grabs me by the shoulder. Listen to me. One day you will have children, and you will learn that you would rather suffer 1,000 torments than let one hair on their heads be harmed. Give me this gift. Let me protect you as I should have protected Lys. The name bursts from her lips. As I should have protected your fa. She snarls at her inability to speak and spins away, knocking her bow, letting arrow after arrow loose. The ghost will fall. Her flesh will wither. The ghost was never me. It was her, mirror of Sarah, risen from the dead. But if that's the case, then this is one line of the prophecy. I will fight. Mother spins, grabs a shrike, and heaves her up. The blood shrike's eyes flutter open, and she leans heavily on my mother, who then shoves her at me. I have no choice but to catch her, my knees nearly buckling at the sudden weight. But the shrike rights herself, trying to stay steady on her feet, using me as support. I love you, Liar! The sound of my name on Mother's lips is more than I can bear. And I am shaking my head, trying to tell her no through my sobs. Not again. Not again. Tell your brother everything, she says. If he doesn't know already, tell him I am proud of him. Tell him that I am sorry. She rises up from the rocks and darts away, drawing the Karkans' fire as she skewers them with more arrows. No! I scream. But she is doing this. And if I don't move, it will be for nothing. I look at her for one more moment, and I know I will never forget how her white hair snaps like a victory banner, and how her blue eyes shine with fury and determination. She is finally the lioness, the woman I knew as a child, and somehow more. Bloodstrike! I call to her as I turn up the pilgrim road. Wake up! Please! Who? She tries to see me, but her ravaged face is drenched with blood. It's Lyra, I say. You must walk, do you understand? You must! I saw white smoke. Walk, Shrike! Walk! Step by step, we make our way up the pilgrim road until we are high enough to see over the bodies and into the Karkhan force, diminished but still enormous. High enough to watch as my mother picks them off one by one, grabbing the arrows the Karkhans are hailing down upon her, giving us as much time as she can. And then I do not look back anymore. I just move, half dragging, half urging the blood shrike onward and upward. But it is too far, and the shrike is too injured. Her clothes soaked with blood, her body heavy with pain. I'm so sorry, she whispers. Go on without. Blood shrike! A voice from up ahead and a flash of silver. I know that face, the mask who helped me at Koth, the one who set me free months ago. Avitus Harper. Thank the bleeding skies! I've got this side, Lyra. Harper throws the shrike's other arm over his shoulder, and together we pull her up the path, then down across a shallow bowl to a cave where a handsome, dark-skinned mask waits. Dex Atreus.
Harper.
The shrike slurs in a whisper.
Hold you. Collapse the tunnels. You disobeyed orders.
With respect, shrike. They were stupid bleeding orders, Harper says. Stop talking.
I twist my head around as we enter the cave. From this height, I can see down the hill to the gap. To the Karkhans who are now making their way up the path with no one to block their way.
No, I whisper. No, no, no.
But we are in the cave now, Dex ushering us forward quickly.
Blast it, Avitus says. Lyra, come quickly. They're not far behind.
I don't want to leave her,
I want to scream.
I don't want her to die alone. I don't want to lose her again.
When we are at the end of a long passage lined with blue fire torches, an earth-shattering rumble booms out, followed by the unmistakable sound of thousands of pounds of rocks falling. And then, silence. I slip down onto the ground beside the shrike. She cannot see me, but she reaches out her hand and takes mine.
You knew her, she whispers. The cook.
It takes me a long time to answer. By the time I do, the shrike has lost consciousness.
Her name was Mira of Sarah,
I speak, though no one can hear me.
And yes, I knew her.
Part 5. Beloved.
Chapter 57. The Blood Shrike. Lyra of Sarah cannot hold a tune to save her life, but her hum is sweet and light and strangely comforting. As she moves around the edges of the room, I try to get a sense of my surroundings. Lamplight filters through an enormous window, and I feel a nip in the air, a sign that summer closes in the north. I recognize the low arched buildings beyond the window and the large square it faces. We are in Delphinium. There is a weight to the air, a heaviness. Distantly, lightning flashes over the Neverness. I can smell the storm. My face feels strange, and I reach my hands up. The mask, the djinn. I thought it had been a nightmare.
But as I feel my own skin for the first time in 7 years, I realize that it was not a dream. My mask is gone, and a piece of my soul with it. Lyra hears me move and turns. I see the blade at her waist, and on instinct I reach for my own.
No need for that, Bloodshrike.
She tilts her head, her face not exactly friendly, but not unkind either.
We didn't drag you through 100 miles of caves, so your first act upon waking would be to stab me.
A cry sounds from nearby, and I force myself to sit up, eyes wide. Lyra rolls her eyes.
The Emperor, she says, is always hungry, and when he doesn't get food, skies help us all.
Livy, there.
Safe.
A shadow flickers across the scholar girl's face, but she hides it quickly.
Yes. Your family is safe.
A whisper of movement at the door, and Avitas is there. Immediately Lyra excuses herself. I understand her quick smile, and I flush. For just a second, I see the look on Harper's face, not the carefully controlled blankness that all masks wear, but the heartfelt relief of a friend. Though if I am being honest, it is not the look of someone who thinks of me as just a friend. I would know. I want to say something to him. You came for me. You and Lyra dragged me from the claws of death himself. You have more of your father's goodness in you than you will ever acknowledge. Instead, I clear my throat and swing my legs, shaking with weakness, over the side of the bed. Report, Captain Harper. His silver eyebrows flick up for a moment, and I think I see frustration in his eyes. He crushes it, the way I would. He knows me by now. He knows what I need.
We have 7,520 marshals who fled Antium, he says. Another 1,634 scholars. We believe that at least 10,000 more, Illustrians and Mercators, left before the invasion, or were siphoned out by the Commandant.
And the rest?
Half died in the siege. The other half remains the prisoners of the Karkans. The barbarians have enslaved them.
As we knew they would. Then we must free them, I say. What of Karras?
She retreated to Serra and established the capital there.
Avitas pauses, attempting to get hold of his anger.
The Illustrian Paters have named her Empress, and the Empire has embraced it. Antium's fall is blamed on Marcus and...
And on me. I led the defense of the city, after all. I failed.
Quinn Veturius has pledged his fealty to Emperor Zacharias and Gens Aquila, Harper says, as have the Illustrian Gens of Delphinium. The Commandant has declared your nephew an enemy of the Empire. All who support him or his claim are to be crushed forthwith.
None of what he says surprises me, not anymore. All my plotting and scheming was for nothing. If I'd have known civil war was inevitable, I'd have killed Karras outright, whatever the consequences. At least Antium wouldn't be in the hands of Grimmar. The storm rolls closer, and rain begins to patter thinly on the cobblestones outside. Harper stares openly at me, and I turn my head away, wondering how my face must look. I wear black fatigues, but without my mask I feel strange. Naked. I remember what the Commandant said before she fled Antium.
I wonder if it will hurt.
She knew. It's why she left me alive. The Nightbringer must have ordered it. Harper lifts a hand to my cheek and traces one side, then the other. You haven't seen yourself, he says.
I haven't wanted to.
You have scars, he says. Two of them, like twin Sims.
Do I?
The words come out, a whisper, and I brusquely clear my throat. How bad is it? They are beautiful. His green eyes are thoughtful. Your face couldn't be anything but beautiful, Bloodshrike, with or without the mask. My blush rises, and this time there is no mask to hide it. I don't know what to do with my hands. My hair must look a mess. I must look a mess. Doesn't matter. It's just Harper. But it's not just Harper anymore, is it? He was loyal to the Commandant. He tortured you on Marcus's orders. But he was never truly loyal to Karras. As for the interrogation, how the hells can I judge him for that after what I ordered Dex to do to Mamie, to Tribe Scythe? He's Elias's brother. My thoughts are a welter of confusion. I cannot make sense of them. Arvatas reaches for my hands, pulling them into his own, examining them with such care. He draws a line up my forearm with the tip of his finger, from one freckle to another. At that feather-like touch, every nerve ending in my body awakens. I inhale unsteadily, tormented by his scent, by the triangle of skin at his throat. He leans close. The curve of his lower lip is the only softness in a face that looks cut from stone. I wonder, do his lips taste the way I think they must, like honey and cinnamon tea on a cold night? When I lift my gaze to his, he hides nothing. Finally, finally unmasking his desire. The power of it is dizzying, and I do not protest when he pulls me close. Arvatas stops when he's a hair's breadth from my lips. Careful. Always so careful. In that moment of waiting, he lays himself bare. Only if you want it. I close the distance, my own need tearing through me with a force that leaves me shaken. I expected my impatience. I did not anticipate his. For someone who is always so infuriatingly calm, he kisses like a man who will never be sated. More. I crave his hands in my hair, his lips on my body. I should get up, lock the door. It is the intoxicating force of that impulse that stops me cold, that compresses my thoughts into two equally clear sentiments. I want him. But I cannot have him. As suddenly as I met Harper's lips, I pull myself away. His green eyes are dark with want, but when he sees my expression, he inhales sharply. Look at me. He is about to say my name, my heart's name, the way he did in his mind when I sang him well. And if I let him, I will be undone. Look at me, hell. Bloodshrike, Captain Harper. I harness my training and give him my coldest glare. He is a distraction. Only the Empire matters. Only your people matter. The Marshals are in far too much danger for either of us to allow distractions. I withdraw my hands from his sharply. I am the Bloodshrike. You would do well to remember it. For a moment, he is frozen, pain flashing nakedly across his face. Then he stands and salutes, the consummate mask once more. Of course, Bloodshrike, sir. Permission to return to duty. Granted. After Harper leaves, I feel hollow, lonely. Voices rise from nearby, and I force myself to my feet and down the hallway. Thunder growls. Close enough to mask my footsteps as I approach the open door to what must be Livia's room. People saved you from the Karkans, though doing so put them at great risk. I beg you, Empress, begin your son's reign with an act befitting a true emperor. Free the scholar slaves. It's not so simple. I recognize Faris's rumble. Isn't it? The clarity and strength in my sister's voice make me stand up taller. She always hated slavery, like our mother. But unlike mother, it's clear she plans to do something about it.
Lyra of Sera does not lie. A group of scholars saved us from the Karkans, who infiltrated the tunnels. They carried me when I was too weak to walk, and it was a scholar who nursed Emperor Zacharias when I lost consciousness. We found the mosses that fed your people in the tunnels. Lyra's voice is arch and I scowl. If not for us, you'd have all starved to death. You've made a just case for your people. Livia's voice is so calm the tension dissipates instantly. As Empress Regent, I decree that every scholar who escaped the tunnels is now a free man. Lieutenant Varys, pass the news to the Paters of Delphinium. Captain Dex, ensure that the martial response is not overly emotional. I step into the room then, and Livia takes a step toward me, stopping short at my warning glare. I shift my attention to the dark-haired bundle on the bed, freshly fed and fast asleep. He got bigger, I say, surprised. They do that, Lyra smiles. You should not yet be up and about, Bloodshrike. I wave off her fussing but sit when my sister insists. Did you see Elias, Lyra? Did you speak with him? Something in her face changes, a fleeting pain I know all too well. She has spoken with him then. She has seen what he's become. He's returned to the forest. I have not tried to find him. I wanted to make sure you were well first, and you've been busy, I say, now that your people have chosen you as a leader. Her reluctance is written all over her face, but instead she shrugs. For now, perhaps. And the Nightbringer? The Nightbringer has not been seen since the siege, she says. It has been more than a week. I expected him to have set his brethren free by now. But she takes in my expression. The rain pours down hard now, a steady lash against the windows. But you feel it too, don't you? Something is coming. Something is coming, I agree. He wants to destroy the scholars, and he plans on using the marshals to do it. Lyra's expression is unreadable. And will you let your people be used? I do not expect the question. Livia, however, appears unsurprised, and I have the distinct feeling that she and Lyra have already had this conversation. If you plan to take the throne back for your nephew, Lyra says, you will need allies to battle the Commandant. Strong allies. You don't have the men to do it on your own. And if you don't want your people utterly destroyed by the Djinn and the Martial Army, I retort, you will need allies too, particularly ones who know the Martials well. We stare at each other like two wary dogs. The Augur mentioned something to me about the Nightbringer a few weeks ago, I offer finally, before the siege on Antium. The truth of all creatures, man or djinn, lies in their name. A spark of interest in Lyra's face. Cook told me something similar, she says. She said that to know the Commandant's story would help destroy her. And I know someone with unique skills who can help us. Us? Help my people, Bloodshrike. I can see how much it costs Lyra to ask this of me. And I, and my allies, will help you win back your nephew's crown. But she cocks her head, and as I'm trying to puzzle out her look, she whips a dagger from her waist and flings it at me. What the bleeding hells? I pluck the blade out of the air on instinct and turn it on her in the time it takes to blink twice. How dare, if I'm going to carry Serik's steel, Lyra says quite calmly. Then I'd like to learn to use it. And if I'm going to be an ally to a marshal, I would like to fight like one. I gape at her, distantly taking note of Livia's quiet smile. Lyra looks down at Zacharias, and then out the window, and that shadow passes over her face again. Though I wonder, would you teach me to use the bow, Bloodshrike? A memory rises from the haze of the past week,
Cook's strong hands as she shot arrow after arrow into the Karkans.
"I love you, Lya," she'd said.
Lya's face as Cook howled at her to get me to the Augur's cave. And older memories. Cook's fierceness when she told me she'd murder me if I hurt Lya. The way, when I healed that old woman, some distant music within her reminded me of the scholar girl. And suddenly, I understand. Mother. I remember the face of my own mother as she went to her death. "Strength, my girl," she'd said. "Curse this world for what it does to the mothers, for what it does to the daughters. Curse it for making us strong through loss and pain, our hearts torn from our chests again and again. Curse it for forcing us to endure." When I meet the scholar girl's stare, I realize she's been watching me. We do not speak. But for this moment, she knows my heart, and I know hers. "Well?" Lya of Sera offers her hand. I take it.
Chapter 58. The Soul Catcher. It takes many days for the ghost to speak his pain. Listening to it chills my blood. He suffers each memory, a rush of violence and selfishness and brutality that, for the first time, he must feel in all its horror. Most of the ghosts have passed quickly, but sometimes their sins are so great that Martha does not let them move on, not until they have suffered what they inflicted. So it is with the ghost of Marcus Farrar. Through it, his brother remains at his side, silent, patient. Having spent the past 9 months tied to his twin's corporeal body, Zack has had plenty of time to suffer what he was. He waits now for his brother. The day finally comes when Ma'atha is satisfied with Marcus's suffering. The twins walk beside me quietly, one on each side. They are empty of anger, of pain, of loneliness. They are ready to pass on. We approach the river, and I turn to the brothers. I sift through their minds dispassionately and find a memory that is joyful. In this case, a day they spent together on the rooftops of Silas before they were taken for Blackcliff. Their father bought them a kite. The winds were fair, and they flew it high. I give the brothers that memory, so that they might slip into the river without troubling me further. I take their darkness, that which Blackcliff found within them and nurtured, and Martha consumes it. Where it goes, I do not know. I suspect, however, that it might have something to do with that seething sea I saw when I spoke to Martha and the creatures lurking within it. When I look back at the twins, they are boys once more, untainted by the world. And when they step into the river, they do it together, small hands clasped. The days go swiftly now, and with Ma'atha joined fully to me, I cycle through the ghosts, dividing my attention between many at a time, as easily as if I am made of water and not flesh. The djinn chafe at Ma'atha's power, but though they hiss and whisper at me still, I can usually silence them with a thought, and they trouble me no more. At least for now. When I have been back in the waiting place more than a week, I suddenly feel an outsider's presence far to the north, near Delphinium. It takes me only a moment to realize who it is.
"Leave it," Ma'atha says in my head. "You know she will bring you no joy."
I would like to tell her why I left. I have let go of her. But sometimes old images drift to the shores of my mind, leaving me restless. Perhaps if I do, she will cease to haunt me. I feel Ma'atha sigh, but he speaks no more, and in a half hour I can see her through the trees, pacing back and forth. She is alone. "Lya." She turns, and at the sight of her, something in me twists, an old memory. A kiss,
a dream. Her hair like silk between my fingers, her body rising beneath my hands. Behind me, the ghosts whisper, and in the ocean tide of their song, the memory of Lyra fades away. I draw on another memory, that of a man who once wore a silver mask and who felt nothing when he did. In my mind, I put on the mask again. It is not your time yet, Lyra of Serra, I say. You are not welcome here. I thought... She shudders. Are you all right? You just left. You must go. What happened to you? Lyra whispers. You said we would be together. You said we would find a way. But then... She shakes her head. Why? Thousands across the Empire died, not because of the Karkans, but because of the ghosts. Because the ghosts possessed whomever they could and made them do terrible things. Do you know how they escaped?
Did Ma'atha...
I failed to hold the borders. I failed to uphold my duty to the waiting place. I put everything else first. Strangers, friends, family, you. Because of that, the borders fell.
You didn't know. There was no one to teach you.
She takes a deep breath, her hands pressed together.
Do not do this, Elias. Do not leave me. I know you're in there. Please, come back to me. I need you. The Bloodshrike needs you. The tribes need you.
I walk to her, take her hands, look down into her face. Whatever I want to feel is dulled now by the steady, soothing presence of Ma'atha, the thrum of ghosts in the waiting place.
Your eyes,
she runs a finger across my brows.
They're like hers.
Like Shaver's, I say, as they should be.
No,
Lyra says.
Like the Commandant's.
The words trouble me, but that too will fade, in time. Elias is who I was, I say. The soul catcher, the Banu al-Ma'atha, the chosen of death, that is who I am. But do not despair. We are, all of us, just visitors in each other's lives. You will forget my visit soon enough. I reach down and kiss her on the forehead. Be well, Lyra of Serra. When I turn away, she sobs, a soul-deep cry of wounded betrayal.
Take this!
Her voice is wretched, her face streaming tears. She tears a wooden armlet from her bicep and shoves it into my hands.
I don't want it.
She turns away then, makes for the horse waiting nearby. Moments later, I am alone. The wood is still warm from her body. When I touch it, some part of me calls out in rage from behind a shut door, demanding to be set free. But a second later, I shake my head, frowning. The feeling fades. I think to cast the armlet to the grass. I do not need it, and neither does the girl. Something makes me put it in my pocket instead. I try to turn back to the ghosts, to my work, but I am perturbed, and eventually I find myself at the base of a tree, near the spring not far from the ruins of Shaver's cabin, staring out at the water. A memory rises in my mind.
Soon you will learn the cost of your vow, my brother. I hope you do not think too ill of me.
Is that what this feeling is inside? Anger at Shaver?
It is not anger, child,
Ma'atha says gently.
It is simply that you feel your mortality. but you have no mortality anymore. You will live as long as you can serve.
It's not mortality I feel, I say, though it is something uniquely mortal.
Sadness.
A type of sadness, I say, called loneliness. There is a long silence, so long that I think he has left me. Then I feel the earth shift around me, the tree's roots rumble, curving, softening, until they fashion themselves around me into a sort of seat. Vines grow, and flowers burst from them.
You are not alone, Banu al-Ma'atha. I am here with you.
A ghost drifts close to me, flitting about in agitation, searching, always searching. I know her, the wisp.
Hello, young one.
Her hand drifts across my face.
Have you seen my lovey?
I have not, I say, but this time I give her all of my attention. Can you tell me her name?
Lovey.
I nod, feeling none of the impatience I felt before. Lovey, I say. What about you? What is your name?
My name,
she whispers.
My name? She called me Amma, but I had another name.
I sense her agitation and try to soothe her. I seek a way into her memories, but I cannot find one. She has built a wall around herself. When she tilts her head, her profile manifests briefly. The curves of her face strike a deep and visceral chord. I feel like I'm catching a glimpse of someone I've always known.
Corinna.
She sits down next to me.
That was my name. Before I was Amma, I was Corinna.
Corinna. I recognize the name, though it takes me a moment to realize why. Corinna was my grandmother's name, Quinn's wife. But it couldn't be. I open my mouth to ask her more, but her head whips around, as if she's heard something. Immediately, she is back in the air, vanishing into the trees. Something has spooked her. I run my mind along the borders of the forest. The wall is strong. No ghosts lurk near it. Then I feel it. For the second time this day, someone from the outside world enters the waiting place. But this time, it is not a trespasser. This time, it is someone returning home.
Chapter 59, The Nightbringer. In the deep shade of the waiting place, the ghosts sigh their song of regret instead of screaming it. The spirits are quelled. The Banu al-Ma'atha has finally learned what it means to be the chosen of death. Shadows emerge from behind me, 14 in number. I know them, and I hate them, for they are the wellsprings of all my sorrows, the augurs. Do they still hear the screams of the jinn children who are slaughtered with cold steel and summer rain? Do they recall how my people begged for mercy even as they were sealed into the jinn grove? You cannot stop me, I say to the augurs. My vengeance is written. We are here to witness, Cain speaks. He is a far cry from the power-obsessed scholar king of a millennium ago. Strange to think that this withered creature is the same man who betrayed the jinn, promising peace while plotting destruction. Those who ignited the blaze must suffer its wrath, he says. What do you think will happen to you when all the magic you stole from my people is restored to them? I ask. The magic that has sustained you in your pitiful forms for all these years. We will die. You wish to die. Immortality was a more painful burden than you anticipated, was it not, Snake? I fashion my magic into a thick, iridescent chain and lash the augurs to me. They do not fight it. They cannot, for I am home. And here amid the trees of my birth, my magic is at its most powerful. Fear no more, Your Majesty. You will die. Your pain will end. But first, you will watch as I destroy everything you hope to save, so that you may know what your greed and violence have wrought. Cain only smiles, a vestige of his old conceit. The djinn will be freed, he says. The balance between worlds restored. But the humans are ready for you, Nightbringer. They will prevail. You poor fool, I seize him. And when he unleashes his power to throw me off, the air shimmers briefly before I shake the attack away like a human would a mosquito. Look into my eyes, you wretch of a man, I whisper. See the darkest moments of your future. Witness the devastation I will unleash. Cain stiffens as he looks, as he sees in my gaze field upon field of the dead. Villages, towns, cities aflame. His people, his precious scholars, obliterated at the hands of my brethren, ground down until even their name is no longer remembered. The mariners, the tribes, the marshals, all under the bloody, iron-fisted rule of Keris Veturia. And his champions, those three flames in which he placed all his hopes, Lyra of Serra, Helene, Aquila, and Elias Veturius? I smother those flames, for I have taken the blood shrike's soul. The waiting place has taken the soul catcher's humanity, and I will crush Lyra of Serra's heart. The augur tries to turn away from the nightmare images. I do not let him. Still so arrogant, I say. So assured that you knew what was best. Your foretellings showed you a way to free yourselves and release the djinn while protecting humanity. But you never understood the magic. Above all else, it is changeable. Your dreams of the future only bloom if they have a firm hand to nurture them to life. Otherwise, they wither before they ever take root. I turn to the djinn grove, dragging the struggling augurs with me. They push at me with their stolen magic, desperate to escape now that they know what is to come. I wrap them tighter. They will be free soon enough. When I arrive among the haunted trees, the suffering of my brethren washes over me. I want to scream. I drive the star into the ground. Now complete, it bears no sign of its splintering and stands as tall as I do, the four-pointed diamond hearkening to the symbol of Blackcliff. The augurs adopted the shape to remind themselves of their sins, a pathetic human notion that by drowning in guilt and regret, one can atone for any crime, no matter how despicable. When I place my hands on the star, the earth stills. I close my eyes. 1,000 years of loneliness. 1,000 years of deceit. 1,000 years of plotting and planning and atonement. All for this moment. Dozens of faces flood my mind, all those who possessed the star, all those I loved. Father, mother, brother, daughter, friend, lover. Release the jinn. The star groans in response to my command. The magic within its metal twisting, warping, pouring into me and drawing from me, both at once. It is alive, its consciousness simple but thrumming with power. I seize that power and make it mine. The augurs shudder, and I bind them tighter, all but Cain. I weave a shield from my magic, protecting him from what is to come, though he will not thank me for it. Release the jinn! The trees moan awake, and the star fights me, its ancient sorcery sluggish and unwilling to bend. You have held them long enough. Release them! A crack echoes through the grove, loud as summer thunder. Deep in the waiting place, the sows of the spirits transform into screams as one of the trees splits, then another. Flames pour from those great gouges, bursting forth as if the gates to all of the hells have been breached. My flames, my family, my jinn. The trees explode into cinders, their glow painting the firmament an infernal red. Moss and shrubs curdle to soot, leaving an acres-wide black ring. The earth shudders, a tremor that will shatter glass from Marin to Navium. I taste fear on the air, from the augurs and the ghosts, from the humans that infest this world. Visions flash across my mind. A scarred soldier cries out, reaching for daggers that will not help her. A newborn babe awakes, howling. A girl I once loved gasps, wheeling her horse about to gaze with gold eyes at the crimson sky over the forest of dusk. For an instant, every human within a thousand leagues is united in a moment of ineffable dread. They know. Their hopes, their loves, their joy. All will soon be naught but ash. My people stagger toward me, their flames coalescing into arms, legs, faces. First a dozen, then 20, then hundreds. One by one, they tumble from their prisons and gather near me. At the edge of the clearing, 13 of the 14 augurs silently collapse into heaps of ash. The power that they siphoned from the jinn flows back to its rightful owners. The star crumbles. Dusty remnants swirling restlessly before disappearing on a swift wind. I turn to my family. Beshem, I say. My children. I gather the flames close, hundreds and hundreds of them. Their heat is a balm on the soul I thought I had long since lost. Forgive me, I beg them. Forgive me for failing you. They surround me, touch my face, pull away my cloak, and release me into my true form, the form of flame, which I have repressed for 10 centuries. You freed us, they murmur, our king, our father, our Meheria. You did not forget us. The humans were wrong. I had a name once, a beautiful name, a name spoken by the great dark that came before all else, a name whose meaning brought me into existence and defined all I would ever be. My queen spoke my name long ago. Now my people whisper it. Meheria. Their long-banked flames blaze brighter, from red to incandescent white, too bright for human eyes, but glorious to mine. I see their power and magic, their pain and rage. I see their soul-deep need for vengeance. I see the bloody reaping to come. Meheria! My children say my name again, and the sound of it drops me to my knees. Meheria! Beloved.
This is Fiona Hardingham. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of A Reaper at the Gates by Saba Tahir. This program was directed by Kathy Thornburn. Executive producer, Diane McKiernan. Text copyright 2018 by Saba Tahir. Production copyright 2018, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.